WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, this 28th of March 2010. The digital revolution, maybe the defining feature of our generation, of our times, and ultimately of our species. We'll know that at some point. Today we're going to be talking with one of the great scientists involved in the creation of the digital revolution, who's also emerged as one of its leading critics. We're going to be talking with Jaron Lanier about his new book, You Are Not a Gadget, today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
A new bill has been introduced in the House that would require all public information from most federal government agencies to be made available online. Ellen Miller, executive director of the Sunlight Foundation, says that the Public Online Information Act would redefine what public information actually means.
The way the government has interpreted what public information means is to print out a copy of a report or a document or a database and put it in a manila file folder and put it in the basement of an office building and eventually truck it out to some kind of warehouse storage and essentially lock it up in a cabinet where no one can see it.
The information hidden in those cabinets is only available in Washington, D.C. between the hours of 9 and 5.
Our thought is that government needs to come into the 21st century and understand that it's actually their responsibility to provide information in a way that citizens will actually access it.
The law would help citizens gain a better understanding of how their government functions.
It provides a measure of accountability for what government does in our name. It gives information to citizens, enabling them to ask their lawmakers questions in town hall meetings. It provides the kind of information that lawmakers can ask of the executive branch, you know, how this program is working or how this program is not working. So there are a number of very, very significant benefits, public benefits, from this legislation.
Having all sorts of government information is a kind of public good, Miller says. There's no telling what kinds of useful applications and mashups will be created. Imagine the array of amazing tools created using government weather information or GPS satellites being extended to all kinds of federal data.
Citizens need to know, citizens want to know, citizens are accessing information about things that matter to them. And I think it's paternalistic to suggest that we're going to only make this kind of data available because we don't really know what citizens want. So if we can put the data online, require it to be online, and provide a system where it's easy to find, you know, keyword searches through data, we, I think, will be stunned as a nation as to how this information is used to create a better democracy and a more engaged citizenry.
For more information about the Public Online Information Act, go to sunlightfoundation.org. And now, a special commentary by Media Minute's own Candace Clement.
It's starting to feel like we're stuck in the media twilight zone. While channel surfing the other day, I came across a fresh-faced young reporter for a cable network aggressively following an important person around an airport and refusing to let up with his questions. The unwilling interviewee grew angry, suddenly snapping and shouting at the reporter to leave him alone. "Do you think you're immune to questions?" the reporter shouted back repeatedly. I was speechless. "Do you think you're immune to questions?" It was perfect, such a simple and powerful question. This would have been the most hopeful piece of journalism I had seen in years if it weren't for one small detail. This was not a journalist from CNN or Fox or MSNBC. The exchange was between an E-network reporter and a Hollywood celebrity. And that's when it clicked. Could the news media learn something from the paparazzi? I started to imagine that paparazzi reporter in the press pool, doggedly pursuing a line of questioning and refusing to take no comment for an answer. In an age of woefully tame media, old D.C. journalists could learn a thing or two from reporters traditionally considered at the bottom of the news industry's barrel. Imagine if Washington journalists were as aggressive and relentless as a paparazzo desperately trying to get a Brangelina quote, or demanded real answers from the Wall Street investment firms who tanked the economy, got a taxpayer bailout, and then paid out exorbitant bonuses to executives. Mainstream media are increasingly using cost-cutting measures like slashing jobs and reorienting their newsroom staff to cover the kind of soft and cheap-to-produce entertainment and gossip stories that the paparazzi specialize in. Consolidated media has meant only a certain kind of journalist makes it to the top and gets press credentials, the type who asks softball questions that politicians can hit with their eyes closed and that don't compromise the media company's own interests. With CNN's homepage regularly plastered with celebrity news, it doesn't seem unfair to ask journalists to learn a basic lesson from the paparazzi. Don't take no for an answer.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a live program coming to you today, March 28, 2010. Our guest today, someone I've been looking forward to having, is the author of a new book. And as a bit of background, I was traveling in an airport a couple months ago with John Nichols, who were doing some work on our new book. And we were browsing some books in the bookstore, and we both stumbled across this book. And we'd started reading it separately in the airport. We were sort of standing next to each other, didn't realize the other one was reading. We were both engrossed in it. And we turned around, said, "You got to look at this book." And as fate would have it, it was the same book. And it was the book, You Are Not a Gadget. And it is by our guest today, Jaron Lanier. Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist, composer, visual artist, and author, probably best known as the inventor of the term virtual reality, and he worked on that. He was one of the people who developed virtual reality in the 1980s. He's a journalist, a musician, as I said. He's been acclaimed as one of the top 100 public intellectuals in the world by the readers of Foreign Policy and Prospect magazines, and he has a list of honors that could take us the whole hour to discuss, but rather let's talk about his new book. Jaron Lanier, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, first off, is there something about your background before we talk about the book that I didn't mention that would help people understand what we're about to talk about, the book, a little bit more?
My background. Well, you know, one thing that's unusual about my background is I'm one of these folks who ended up with a career in the sciences without going through a traditional academic path. I had very little schooling. I have had some college courses, but I don't even have a high school degree. And I think that allowed me to, and the thing is, in technology, there's a very hard test of whether what you're doing is true or if it works. So ultimately, the work itself speaks rather than whatever your credentials are. So I was able to overcome that. But at the same time, I hope that that odd background gave me a little bit more schooling in the of street wisdom or the school of hard knocks. Or, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't really have an academic perspective. And I think in this particular case, it's been a help. That's the only difference I can really see.
Well, let's certainly hope no state legislatures in Illinois are listening to this and saying maybe we don't need to
have. Well, you know, that's a problem because I often have, like, teenagers or people in their 20s will come to me and say, "Well, why should I do all this work to get my PhD?" And I just have to say, I was very lucky, and there's almost nobody like me. So if you want to play very, very long odds, you can try to do it. It just, I think it's very hard and very unusual. It just happened to work out in my case.
And why did you decide, Jaron Lanier, to write this book, You Are Not a Gadget, a Manifesto?
Well, you know, I just felt that my field had gone a little crazy, and in a sense a little crazy with power. What happened was the nerds, if you will, my friends and colleagues, the people I've grown up with who are my neighbors and coworkers and students, just became extraordinarily powerful. My friends who run Google have something that's essentially like a commercial version of the NSA, this database on what everybody's doing, and likewise other friends I have at Facebook. And power makes you nutty. And this degree of power kind of mixed with an ideology that was very nerdy, that was very machine-centric, and has led to this idea about how civilization should work, how culture should work, that I think is ultimately anti-human. And it's not so much that anybody's evil in the equation. It's just that people kind of go nuts when they get too much power too quickly. It's kind of like being on top of an oil field. You know, you start to believe in yourself too much. You start to lose an ability to really question yourself. And people are afraid to tell you what they really think. And so I decided I wouldn't be afraid to just tell my friends what I really think. And to their credit, I haven't been ejected from our world. I'm still a member in good standing. And it's, in fact, one of the things that's just astonishing to me is how warmly the book has been received. It's actually a vastly different reception than I was expecting. I thought there was going to be a lot of rancor internally, and it's actually been pretty good. So I'm starting to feel very good about having written the book. But just very briefly, what the book suggests is that this sort of there's a nerd-centric view in which, well, just to put it bluntly, machines are more important than people. And so the idea is that the Internet is turning into this super being, and the purpose of people is to feed the super being so it becomes smarter and better, and it becomes the thing that's post-human, the thing that's better than people that we're all working towards. And meanwhile, as a side effect of that, all the power and money should accumulate in the people who run the machine. So journalists don't get paid, but the people who run the databases that aggregate what journalists do, those people get rich. So Google gets rich, but journalists get poor. But that's just the side effect of this great quest to make the greater glory of the machine. And that whole direction is kind of bundled up, and there are a lot of variations of it, and I'm not saying that everybody believes the same thing, but that general thrust is the thing that I felt needed to be criticized.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Jaron Lanier, author of the new book, You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto, which has just been published this year by NOF, and I've had the privilege of reading this book. And I think your friends are right. Whatever one might think of the argument, this is one of the most provocative books that I've read in a long time. It was really a pleasure to read. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Jaron Lanier, the number here at WILLAM580 is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Jaron Lanier, when I started reading your book, I was struck in the first chapter especially how much of the argument reminded me of an argument that's now almost a decade old by a law professor who's been a guest in this program frequently named Larry Lessig. Mm-hmm. And Larry's at Harvard now. And he wrote his first great book on the web and on the Internet was called Code. And his argument was that that people who just look at markets and just look at laws are missing how much of the crucial decisions about how the digital world will develop are being done by software engineers.
Yeah, I would say that at this point, software engineers have more effect on how people's lives are conducted than either politicians or businessmen. And by the way, software engineers ran the hedge fund computers that sank the economy, and the process of the process of economic speculation has become dominated by computer science, and it's remarkably similar to the stuff I was just talking about. A hedge fund computer and a Google or a Facebook computer are really doing essentially the same thing and playing the same role in the world.
And, you know, one of the things you talk about early on, to give an example of what you talk about, how, you know, what engineers do when they make decisions, sometimes locks in place something that you really can't change. Once everyone starts doing it, you get what economists call path dependency. It's almost unchangeable once everyone adopts a certain technological format or software. And one example you give that, and I'm not a scientist, this is outside my area or even a software person, but the technology or the software that's used to do music digitally, MIDI, MIDI.
MIDI. Yes, yes.
And, you know, I thought that was a really good example of how this works and what the strengths and limitations are and the unintended consequences are of when a software technology is developed. Can you explain that?
Sure. One of the problems with running civilization by software is that software can get stuck in patterns that are very hard to undo. And there are various reasons for this, but basically it's much harder to undo software than it is to undo laws, let's say. We just had a new law about how healthcare will run in this country. At some point when healthcare is more locked into a software system, it might be even harder to change than it was to change our laws, if that's imaginable. This is why software has so much power. And I don't want to get into all the little technical nits of it, but there's a sense in which one particular way of connecting things together in software works and all the other ones fall away. So it creates natural monopolies, essentially, again and again and again, and they can be really persistent. And that's why the people who are able to benefit from these things can become sort of arbitrarily rich and powerful.
In the MIDI system,
MIDI is what we say, yes.
Yeah, just for people to get a sense, though, what is that?
Yeah. Okay, well, I happened to be around when it was created. So there's a guy named Dave Smith, who's a synthesizer designer, who's still working and making wonderful instruments. And in the early 80s, he and one of his colleagues, Chet Woods, wanted to connect some keyboards together so you could get the sounds each synthesizer keyboard could make by playing only one of the keyboards at a time. And he invented a little computer protocol. And meanwhile, the Japanese were getting into the digital synthesizer game for the first time, and Yamaha in particular just wanted some standard they could use so that these machines could talk to each other. And I think there was this notion if they chose an American one, it would be more readily accepted in the American market, which was at that time the big export market for them. And so almost instantly this standard took hold, but it was still a tiny microcosm. I mean, I remember, when it was created, the Macintosh wasn't out yet, but some buddies of mine were working on it, and one of them, Jobs probably still doesn't even know this happened, but one of them snuck a prototype Macintosh on the back of his motorcycle out one day, and we quickly made what I believe was the first computer MIDI interface, and I wrote the first sequencer that had a computer controlling a synthesizer over this thing called MIDI.
Mm-hmm.
And we were so excited. And the problem is that once you start a little seed like that, it has a chance to grow into not just a giant oak, but sort of this overpowering oak fortress that controls you. So here we are some years later, and it just turns out this particular MIDI design, while it works obviously, is designed strictly for keyboards, so it can't convey what a saxophone does, it can't convey what a voice does, it can't convey what a guitar does, and so the result is that pop music more and more started to have this kind of checkerboard feel to it, where everything was based on sounds that could be controlled by pressing a key and letting go of the key, and it's completely transformed our music. I mean, the sort of on-off strobing feeling of a lot of dance music, techno music, but just in general, the music you hear, the sort of the sameness of a lot of music is a direct fallout of this particular very innocent day in a garage in the early 80s that we've never overcome. And there have been endless attempts to change it. I mean, there have been international coalitions, there have been governments involved, everyone's always trying to change it. We just can't unseat the thing, even though everybody's really unsatisfied with it.
Our guest today, Jaron Lanier, you've just been listening to, author of the new book, You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, so the phone number, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Jaron Lanier, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. In the book, Jaron Lanier, you sort of discuss, it's not in great length, but you mention and refer to the pre-World Wide Web culture of the Internet, which you were intimately involved with in the 1980s, going into the early 1990s. And for a long time, when I would teach the history of the Internet, most of my students had some awareness of this and had some familiarity with it and sort of had a sense of how things had changed. We're now at a generation where, for my students, I might as well be talking about the War of the Roses.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To discuss this. And maybe you could just talk about what that culture was like and then discuss a comment you make that's quite striking in the book where you say, quote, "The way the Internet has gone sour is truly perverse," unquote. What happened? What's happened to make it perverse?
You know, the thing about history is the reason that younger people should care about the history of the Internet is that it's still not too late to change what it is. And unfortunately, the history of the Internet has been one in which our conception of it has been narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed according to a particular ideology, so that people who are just getting to know it now have no idea what it could be. They have no idea of the freedoms that are potentially available to them. So they're living within this very narrow universe. This is an extremely important point to make, because I very much don't want to be like an older. I mean, I'm 49. That's what counts for like very, very old wizened in the computer world. But I don't want to be somebody saying, "Oh, when we were young, it was better." It's not that I'm telling them to do it differently. I'm asking them to claim the power to know how it could be, to just know the range of options that there are, instead of being locked into this little tiny keyhole that a particular ideology has fed to them, because to not be aware of options is to be self-enslaved, I guess. I mean, it's to limit yourself. So here's the story. Going way back, the very first person to really conceive of how the web could work was Ted Nelson. This is in 1960 is when he started to articulate this, and he's the guy who invented the idea of a link, that one thing would link to another thing. He conceived of this whole thing. He tried to implement it, but he wasn't the right person to do that for various reasons. He didn't have the right personality to keep a team together and so forth. And much later, a much simpler design by a guy named Tim Berners-Lee became the web as we know it. But at any rate, Ted Nelson thought this stuff through with incredible clarity, because a lot of times when somebody comes upon something for the first time, they just see it without baggage. And what he saw was that if all you did was turn the Internet into a giant copying machine where people were constantly file sharing, basically, was what we call it today, it would make everybody poor, because it would sort of socialize just the cultural and artistic and expression-based parts of the world, while people would still have to make their rent and everything somehow. So essentially, it would have a sort of a Maoist effect, where people would have to do more and more physical things just to get by, and you wouldn't be able to live off your heart and your brain anymore. And that would ultimately be a bad thing for people, a bad thing for the future, and it's not what technology should bring us. So he saw all of that extremely clearly. But at the same time, he also hated the media world as it was, where there were these big Hollywood studios and big television networks that served as gatekeepers and had this power structure that you had to fight with just to be heard. That also seemed wrong. And so he imagined a third way, which I still think is the best idea there's ever been for the Internet. And in the third way, there's one single universal account that each person can have, where they can buy or sell what they do. And there's no copying. The technology doesn't support copying. So in something like YouTube or the Apple Store, there's as far as you're concerned, there's only one copy of each thing, and you can access it. And he imagined that universally for the Internet, and then anybody could buy and sell, and any creator would have access to a platform where not only could they be heard, but they could actually make a living and make their rent and pay for their medical care and all of that. Very, very simple idea, very powerful. The reason it didn't happen is really interesting. There were two kinds of people who hated Ted's idea. On the one hand, there were people from the left, and they hated the idea that he would preserve money into the future. In their idea, the whole point of the Internet was to bring about a Maoist utopia. That the thing he was worried about is what they wanted. They wanted to get rid of money, and they wanted a collectivized world. And they used to shout him down viciously over that issue. So that was one type. But then the other type were the people who told him, most people aren't creative, most people don't have anything to say that's worth hearing, most people are basically lumpen, lazy, they want to be couch potatoes. We should design a world that's like the 20th century's television world, but just on steroids or whatever term you prefer, and just accept that most people are going to be dependent on this minority of super-empowered, intellectual, creative people. And that's just reality. And so and Ted said, no. Vast numbers of people actually are creative, actually do have things worth saying. So the great test came in the 90s when Tim Berners-Lee finally made a design that would work, since Ted had never really done it. And now there was suddenly this web. And lo and behold, millions upon millions of people turned out to have things that were worth listening to and just populated the web with wonderful content, and all this stuff started to happen. So the people who thought that only a tiny minority was worth listening to were proven wrong definitively. But then what happened at the turn of the century is there's sort of like the revenge of the capitalists, where there were people saying, you know, all this stuff is happening on the web, and nobody's making money. And, you know, there were a few people who said, well, that's great. So I'll just, if anybody needs an extra service, I'll just do it modestly. And Craig Newmark, who did Craigslist, did something like that, where he created this thing a lot of people used and just made a little business. But other businesses like Google and Facebook have worked really hard to draw people into their sort of web so that the stuff that was happening anyway is now to the service of this database that just sort of makes models of people to sell to advertisers. And then that creates this world where everything is in the service of advertisement, where like the only form of culture, the only form of commerce is advertising. And I'm sorry to go on and on like this. Let me just finish one little piece and then I'll give you a full picture. So for the moment, to say advertising kind of makes sense because, for instance, you can a musician who gives away recorded music can use the internet to advertise for a live gig, but ultimately that stops working. And this is a little hard for people to see, but I'll use the T-shirt example to try to get it across. Right now, that same musician might use the internet to sell T-shirts, but in say 10 or 20 years or some number of years, there'll be cheap robots that can create an arbitrary T-shirt or any article of clothing from designs that you download from the internet. And at that point, the actual design of the clothing will be valueless, just like the contents on a CD are valueless because you can download them. And so as technology gets better and better, more and more of it is just the information, and the robots and the machines get better and better. And so if all people can do is physical stuff, they'll be more and more disempowered as technology gets better, and exactly the opposite is what we should want. So I hope that makes sense.
It does to me, and I think read your book, that will be to them, and I think to listeners it will be. Let's let our listeners participate in the conversation now with Jaron Lanier, our guest author of the new book, You Were Not a Gadget. Jaron Lanier, the computer scientist involved in the creation of virtual reality, has been in the center of everything for the last three decades with regard to the digital revolution. Also an author, journalist, musician, which we'll be talking about in more detail later. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Jaron Lanier. Yes, line 2. Okay, well, line 2 is not apparently there. Hello, line 2.
I'm right here.
Okay, please speak up, sir. You're on the air with Jaron Lanier.
Yes. This is just about a historical detail, but one perhaps of some importance. Early in the show, the guest remarked that the software engineers were like the ones that controlled the computers of the hedge funds that brought down the economy. And your recent guest, Dean Baker, of course, has a different view, that the breakdown of the economy was due to the housing bubble and very little due to what the hedge funds and so forth were doing. And in order to support that, he cited Spain, which has, he said, good financial regulation and didn't have those kinds of problems. But they did have a housing bubble, and they're in just as bad hot water as we are economy-wise. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And this is a little orthogonal to the point you were you're arguing your book, Jaron Lanier. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I know. It's a good comment. I think you have to learn to think a little broadly about how this is working. So there have always been financial bubbles. There have always been tulip crazes. A lot of the things that go on these days have precedence in one form or another. But the difference really with computers is this sort of acceleration, the way that things can come together so extremely quickly, and also the concentration of power. And so this is all. You can always sort of have trouble trying to say it exactly the right way. That Every event is unique, and there are aspects of these times that are similar to previous times, but there are also some things that are different, and I'm obviously trying to focus on the aspects that are different.
Yeah, I must say, also having read Dean Baker's book, I'm not sure Dean would accept exactly that characterization of the financial bubble as his view, but he certainly was on top of the housing bubble entirely.
I mean, the housing bubble was also partially internet-driven. I mean, that's the thing, is that when I talk about the hedge fund computers, I'm not just talking about strictly the hedge fund speculators, but there's a whole, the term we like is ecosystem, that's a popular term now, mm-hmm. but there's a whole ecosystem of related effects. And to give you an example of what I'm talking about, during the period leading up to the real estate crash, if you went online, I'm sure everyone who, unless you're very young and have just come around to the Internet in the last year or something, you'll remember that the Internet was flooded with ads for stupid mortgages. And, in fact, one of the dirty little secrets of Silicon Valley is a lot of the rise of our giant companies like Google and Facebook and so forth has been driven by unsavory promotional schemes. And that's because when you design a whole civilization around advertising, you're not going to get the most brilliant sorts of advertisements. You're going to sort of get sordid advertisements. That's a natural outcome. And so in addition to all the yellow teeth and weight loss scams and so forth, real estate was probably the biggest one for a while. In my view, these things are directly connected because the people who were pushing the real estate scams obviously were playing both sides and had a means of benefiting from them, or thought they did.
Jaron Lanier, you just mentioned advertising, which is a really interesting discussion in your book. And really, you have some very provocative statements about advertising and its role in the Internet and our society. And I think that the way I'd like to frame this is there's a great deal of irony that you recognize in what you say about advertising, because not too long ago, in the early 90s and mid-90s even, there was a notion that advertising, which seemed like to many people this sort of not especially useful form of commercial propaganda, was going to go the way of the dodo bird, because online, with all this information available, no one's going to fall prey for any sort of sales pitch, because they'll be able to access sort of collective intelligence and get the truth about products and prices without getting sales propaganda. And you make, which is striking and phenomenally ironic, the argument that advertising is the center of the Internet universe.
Well, it's the only business plan. I mean, advertising used to be ridiculed as part of the bad old world that we Internet pioneers were going to shut down, and instead we got a world where the only business plan, period, is more and more advertising. And the only motivational system for anybody to do anything is supposed to be advertising. You're supposed to be online to promote yourself. You're supposed to be pushing to have more Twitter followers or whatever the scheme is of the moment. And this is something that exposes a number of enormous lies. I mean, one of them, it's just, it's so obvious that it's almost hard to point it out, which is if something like Google really worked, then the ads would have no value. I mean, the only possibility for what we call advertising is in this sort of gap between the real and the ideal of what these Internet services do. And I would argue that advertising is the wrong word. I'm not anti-advertising per se. I've worked in advertising a little bit, mostly as a musician. I've done jingles and whatnot. And, think what you might of it. It's what it is. It's not, I think there are worse devils to worry about, if it's just an accelerant of some other business, whatever that might be. But what we're really talking about is not advertising. What we're talking about is gatekeeping. What the business ultimately of a Google or a Facebook is to get in between people so that you have to pay to connect with other people. That's ultimately what's going on here, because these ads aren't even persuasive ads exactly. They're just links. So essentially what you're doing is you're paying money for access. And the problem with that is that even Google, and the people at Google are nice. I mean, I've known the founders since very, very early days, and I'm not suggesting that there's an evil plan here, but the problem, and this is also what happened with the hedge funds, is that when you get that much power to where you're in the central node between everybody else, you no longer have the feedback to know when you're becoming evil. You can't even tell. So there's this danger that it gradually becomes a coercive system. And maybe the clearest example of that that's documented is the legal troubles of the company Yelp, which does reviews of local businesses. And in the Bay Area, there are local businesses which accuse them of running a protection racket, where they're saying, you know, like, unless we start paying money to Yelp, we start looking worse online. And so it becomes this coercive thing where you sort of just have to do it. And the whole Internet is kind of turning that way gradually because you have to pay to be connected. And that's what we call advertising, but it really isn't advertising in a traditional sense.
Our guest, Jaron Lanier, author of the brand new book, You Are Not a Gadget, a manifesto published by Knopf and available at fine bookstores everywhere. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live on WILL AM 580. The phone number here again, if you'd like to call into the question or comment for Jaron Lanier, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You know, the book, Jaron, has a lot of really interesting stuff about internet economics, like the stuff in advertising you were just talking about. And I want to go in some detail on music because you're a musician and you talk about the culture. But before we go to there, I do want to hit on something you actually put in a footnote, but it was so striking. You allude to it in the text as well, which is similar to how the understanding of the internet in the 1990s was one that would destroy advertising and was sort of hostile to commercial forces. One of the great claims regarding the internet traditionally, and you still hear it a lot today, is that it really blasts open the economy with phenomenal competition because it lowers the barriers to entry and allows all sorts of businesses to get involved and compete. Yet one of the ironies, again, is that, as you put it, the internet seems to be more an engine of monopoly than competition.
Yeah, you know, this is the sort of disconnect between reality and rhetoric. So still in Silicon Valley, and indeed in the mainstream media and in the blogosphere and the Twitter sphere and all of them, there's this constant drumbeat that, oh, there's more opportunity than ever, there's more opportunity for debate, more people are involved, there are more people getting rich, and there's this huge expansion of goodness. And then if you look at the real world, you see the opposite. You see this recession. You see this complete disappearance of any ability to have dialogue in the political sphere at all. You know, just this total breakdown. There's this sort of Silicon Valley people will say, oh, well, that can't be our problem. That's much bigger than us. Or they might say, well, if you just wait long enough, it'll turn around. But ultimately, I mean, we've had our influence. We really have had a chance to transform the world, and it's not working according to theory. And one thing I find myself saying very, very often is there's nothing wrong with having grand ideas and trying them out. What a shame it would be to be afraid to do that. But there's everything wrong with refusing to look at the results and make adjustments. And what we're doing is we're refusing to look at the real world to see if we're actually helping. And it's apparent that that's not what's going on here.
And let's talk for a second about music, because I think one of the really interesting discussions in the book, and I can tell, obviously, an area you know a great deal about, is the decline of all traditional commercial media and the effect the internet has had on really taking money away from the people who do creative work, both in music and film and journalism, for that matter, and sort of strip away the possibility of having people receive compensation for their labor in these areas dramatically. Mm-hmm. And you get the sense that this is built right into the way the technology has evolved at this point. And again, here you have a lot of, I hear it all the time, we've had guests in the show talk about it, how the new technology is actually going to, the same thing that created the problem is going to solve it. The journalism will be solved by the blogosphere. Music will be solved by people going online and finding new ways to support themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say from reading your book, you don't buy that.
Well, the evidence certainly doesn't support it. I mean, there's this sort of illusory population of all these musicians who are making fantastic livings and doing better than musicians of previous generations because they're giving away their music online, and in exchange they're getting all of these wonderful rewards. And the truth is, if you go out into the world and look for these people, they simply don't exist. They're just tiny handfuls, and in many cases they're people who are claiming to be doing it that are actually trust fund babies who find it fashionable to make the claim. And it's a bit of a cruel thing for me to point out, but it's the truth. So that's the truth for musicians. And for journalists, I mean, you know, the weapons of mass destruction illusion, it took years. It's crazy. I mean, like, the blogosphere just isn't good enough, and volunteerism isn't good enough for the world we face. But more than that, if the idea of the internet is to create mobs, if the basic thing you want to do is to group people together so that you can influence them or charge for connections in a coercive way, which is what we're doing right now, then what you do is you force people into these bubbles, and then the people don't talk across the boundaries of the bubbles. And so you have this insane world in the blogosphere where there are people who reinforce their own opinions and can't talk to each other at all. It's terribly unhealthy, and it almost negates the possibility of journalism.
Before we go back to a couple of callers who are waiting patiently, I just want to wrap up with something you said in the music area that was especially interesting to me and that we haven't really ever talked about on Media Matters before. And I'll preface it by saying that back when I was 11 years old and the Beatles came to America in 1964, and I knew nothing about popular music. It was the first time I ever really listened to it in any detail, like most of my peers at that time. And I said to a friend, I said, you know, it seems to me there's like a limit to the number of songs you can have. I mean, how many melodies can you have? How many beats? There's at some point they're going to run out of original songs. And a friend of looked at me like I was insane. He said, don't you understand mathematics and infinity and all this stuff? There's no shortage. And I forgot about that conversation for 40 years. And then a couple of years ago, a friend and I were talking about how little original music there was. And I said, well, maybe I was right in 1964. We fit the end of creativity, the mathematically, because a point you make in the book, which is that this last decade has been the first decade in a long time when there hasn't been really a dramatic sort of innovative period of original music.
Yeah. Now, this is a controversial part of my book, and my claim has to be really stated carefully because, as you stated it, it's too broad, and I wouldn't quite agree with that statement. What I'm saying is that people can no longer distinguish the pop music of the present from the pop music of 10 years ago, and that's never been true before since the invention of recorded music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a published, peer-reviewed sort of claim, so I can't call it science, but I know many people who've tried it right now, and listeners can try the experiment themselves very easily, and I think you'll find that it's true. Whether that's a bad thing or what it means is, of course, you know, open to question, and there have certainly been a lot of discussions about precisely what it's all about. Some sort of baby boomer people will say, well, the 60s culture was just so brilliant that it'll take, you know, 100 years for anybody to be able to even make another peep after it or something like that. I've heard that as an explanation.
But, I mean, I got it from Jaron, reading your book. I certainly didn't get that from your book, and I think anyone who just reads your three paragraphs will see how nonsensical that claim is. But I do think what came through there was the notion that this is linked to the fact that musicians can't make a living, so there are just a lot of people who would be doing great music who don't have the wherewithal to be able to do it now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that traditionally in human experience, new music has come about hand in hand with new technologies, but also with new economic models for musicians. And what I was expecting to happen with the internet was what I call super Gershwins, who are people, somebody like a figure like a Gershwin couldn't have existed in an earlier generation because the sort of stuff he was going to do was not going to find a patron. But he was able to create a brilliant career that was incredibly diverse. It included everything from selling piano rolls to tickets to sheet music, to doing work on films, all kinds of things. And the world we're creating now is one in which if a musician's going to make it, he or she has to converge on this dwindling oasis of the old media and things like getting into film soundtracks or TV commercials or something like that. And everybody's clamoring and crowding together to try to survive on those last few little droplets as they fade. And in that environment, the economic options just become less varied, and people have to conform to the old world in order to even make it, and it certainly discourages innovation. And for those who say, well, they should just do it as amateurs, who cares if they make a living, they can make their living doing whatever they do, those people don't have kids yet. They don't know what life is like. Like, basically, when you're an undergraduate and you sort of think you're infinite, you can think that way. But it takes a lot of work to make up a new kind of music, and if you don't have a prospect of making a living, you're basically cheating your own children if you make the choice to pursue it. I mean, it's just the reality of life. It's something you have to get about actually being embodied and being human. Unfortunately, there's a real way in which economics, the way you can get by, affects what you can think and what you can do. It's just the truth. And if there's not a diversity of ways for you to get by, it really limits what people can do. And that's what we're doing to people.
Our guest, Jaron Lanier, you just listened to him. He's the author of the new book, You Are Not a Gadget, a manifesto about our digital present and hopeful future. And the book does end, hopefully. We have several callers waiting patiently to talk with Jaron Lanier. We'll get to all of you, and I apologize for my hogging the microphone for the last 10 minutes. Let's start with line two, Champaign County. You're on the air with Jaron Lanier.
Hi, yeah, I hope this isn't too orthogonal or from another outer planet or something, but I would like for you to... I had an argument with a libertarian from the Cato Institute when he was on campus talking about healthcare, and he used the technological revolution, implicitly the Internet, as an example of, you know, like canny venture capitalists and predicting market demand, and that's why explicitly the idea was that, well, if people just shop well for their health care, that everything will be all right. But, I mean, it's so ludicrous, and I wanted you to, if you were to think about this, about how much of DARPA and how much military spending on
high... Oh, okay, yeah.
If you would run with that a little while, because it's just absurd, and it presented it like a commonplace, and, you know, everybody else believed it and were shouting me down for not asking a question or something idiotic like that. And there is a webcast of that, by the way, if people...
Well, thank you very much, caller. Yeah,
a webcast that you might have contributed brilliantly to, and you will not be paid for your contribution, I might add. Online, there's no difference between a libertarian and a Maoist. They're indistinguishable. In the online world, the Cato Institute is a Maoist organization, and, I mean, they've got to eventually learn to recognize that.
And what do you mean by Maoist when you use that term?
A Maoist is a distinct kind of communist who believes that people who work with their elites, meritorious elites who do less physical labor should not be rewarded for that. So there's this sort of back to the fields with you intellectuals feeling about it. There's a destructive kind of anti-elitism in that meritorious intellectual or artistic elites are frowned upon. And there are other ways it's similar too, but that's so. Essentially, the Cato Institute becomes a communist front in the online world, and I just think that's such a plain fact. And but the caller's point is an extremely good one. That this idea that the internet is this chaotic, self-organizing thing is there's a little bit of truth to it, but really much much less than in the popular imagination. We actually have to actively, with centralized control, pump the illusion of self-organization into the Internet, since that's the ideology. I mean, that might sound sort of perverse, but that is actually what goes on. There's a deliberate sense in which the designs try to create an impression of chaos where there need not be one, and an impression of self-organization where there actually really isn't one. The thing has been... It did start as a military project. It has been primarily government financed as far as infrastructure. And obviously, it's run by a few companies. And now the part of it that isn't... one of the things that I want to try to get across is the vast capacity of the Internet is mostly used for... sort of this ritual of chaos that needn't exist. So, for instance, a thing called BitTorrent, which is a protocol for pirating movies and stuff, for the most part, takes up more than half the Internet's bandwidth. And the Internet is a giant global machine. And one of the ways I try to get across why that's a bad idea is that if you were to put the whole Internet, like, in one place, all of the machines involved, all the electricity involved, it would be this truly giant industrial thing. And... there's a green argument. Why are we spewing carbon just to copy movies when we really only need one copy? Why not run the thing more efficiently? And the reason why is that this ideology of chaos is what allows, if everything was just well organized, somebody might just order a movie and pay for it, and they might demand privacy. But if everything's kind of pirated, and people make this trade-off, well, I get it for quote-unquote free, when in fact it isn't free at all. They're paying for it through taxes and many other ways. And then a company like a Facebook or a Google gets to gather data about them to sell to so-called advertising. So they're essentially choosing to support an intelligence agency function in a private company. And just to create that environment requires this incredible inefficiency and this incredible waste and this incredible carbon spewing. But it's part of this ritual of pretending that we're not in control of the Internet when we actually are.
This is WILL Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines for our next caller. Line 4, Kankakee, you're on the air with Jaron Lanier, author of You're Not a Gadget.
Hi, Jaron. This is a marvelous book. It's one that I've been waiting for a long time. Thank you so much for writing it. Now, my question is, how do I buy a book, a copy of it, that'll get the profits to you rather than to Amazon.com?
Well, let me first, God, it's so funny. You know, I am, for better or for worse, a Silicon Valley insider. And I remember at like 4 or 5 years ago, I was seated at some table at a restaurant. And to my left was Bezos, who runs Amazon. And to my right was Eric Schmidt, who runs Google. And the two of them started this conversation where they actually got these kind of maniacal glazes on their eyes. Like, oh, we're going to make a lot of money. We're going to make a lot of money. And I was like, guys, come on. We're in public. Stop. It's just like this madness that overtakes people, this sort of, I don't know, but anyway, Amazon is at least paying people. They're putting price pressure on books and on music even more, but at least there's a principle of paying there, so I'm not quite willing to make Amazon the bad guy. I still think it would be a better world where instead of having one account with Amazon, one account with Apple, and so forth, everybody just has one account, period, so that any particular author can be their own store. That's a better world for everybody. That would be a more empowered world. That would be a world that would really give people autonomy and an ability to build their lives on their hearts and their brains. That's the world I want. But for the moment, you know, I got to say, at least I do make some money from Amazon and other authors do, so I'm not willing to rat on them.
Yeah, Jaron, we're going to go to our...
Oh, but can I just answer the question?
Oh, sure. I'm sorry.
Go to the Random House website, which there's a link to from my website, and there's a list of independent bookstores you can order it from, and then you can support a local independent bookstore, which is the very best thing you can do if you want to buy a copy of my book.
And Jaron Lanier's website is simply jaronlanier.com, so just go right there and you'll see what he's talking about. Jaron Lanier, before we go to our last caller, who's been waiting very patiently, I do want to give you a couple minutes to talk about, I mean, because you close the book in sort of a very interesting way. You go in a direction I didn't fully anticipate, and talk about, you know, what your optimism is or where you see the way out is, why you're not a pessimist.
Right. Well, you know, there's an almost universal stultifying idea in Silicon Valley culture since we became so drunk with power, I guess, that our machines are the creatures that will take over after humanity, and that people are just temporary and people aren't all that important, and we're really creating this super intelligence in our machines that will be more important. And if that sounds like an exaggeration, I got to say, it's not. That's really the ideology now. Right next to the Google campus is this thing called the Singularity University, where people go and do postgraduate studies in exactly this idea, this way of thinking. And it's just dreadful and appalling. And what I'm trying to do is give a vision of a far future of science and computer science that is really still humanistic, it still really believes in people, believes that there's something special inside people we don't fully understand, and tries to imagine a little bit of where that could go. And I'm absolutely convinced that that future is vastly more ambitious and beautiful and surprising and technically rewarding, as well as rewarding in many other ways, than this sort of notion of trying to make the machines come alive, which is something we couldn't even verify would have happened. You know, I mean, it's just this ridiculous fantasy. I explore some ideas in the book, and I'm going to write more about this because I think it's the most important thing to try to get across. But within the book, I talk a little bit about the future of communication, that right now, instead of thinking about the future of communication as one in which we aggregate everybody into this giant collective so that it doesn't even matter who's communicating anymore, what if we imagine a future of communication in which we start to open up whole new channels? And I talk about one thing called post-symbolic communication, which is this idea that within virtual reality you could learn to transform your body in ways to become the thing you're talking about. So, which would be a form of communication that doesn't involve symbols and grammar and all the stuff we're used to in language, but this completely other plane, which has been slightly explored on Earth already by some cephalopods. There are some octopuses and cuttlefish that can morph their bodies and can communicate a little bit that way, and it just shows this hint of this completely different direction of natural communication that could come about. And some of the adventures implied by that are so vast and so grand that they just make this other stuff we're doing seem petty, and I want to try to get that distinction across.
Well, I must say, Jaron Lanier, as I read that, I found it amazing and astonishing and worth the book just in and of itself with that discussion. Let's go back to our final caller, who's been waiting very patiently. Line 4, Champagne, you're on the air with Jaron Lanier.
What are your views in terms of the solutions for, you know, our big issue is in terms of global warming?
Well, global warming is a great example to bring up because it's an example of a problem that cannot be solved without the Internet. We need cloud computing for it because we need to have a massive amount of data from around the world in order to understand what's going on with the climate. Let me just say one thing about global warming, which is that very much as a teenager has to learn to take his or her life into her hands in order to learn to drive. You know, as soon as you become an adult, as soon as you become empowered to run your life, you could kill yourself at any minute if you're not careful. That's what's happening with humanity. We're starting to take control of our fate instead of being subject to the whims of the natural climate and so forth and the natural ecosystem. We're starting to change it. And we'll be permanently imperiled in the way that any adult always is. We'll always have the ability to destroy ourselves in a myriad of ways that will be increasing in number. And that's reality. And ultimately, you know, that's a good thing. I mean, it's us becoming responsible. It's us growing up. I think there's actually a kind of a dignity to it if we can make it through. Obviously, it's scary and it's perilous, as growing up always is. As far as global warming goes, some of the contributions we can make is, first of all, not to have an Internet that's five times bigger than it needs to be just so that people can pirate movies. That's just one of the most stupid anti-green things. And, you know, my plan for going after, like, the pirate party in Europe is not to argue about copyright law, but to argue about green issues. It's just so stupid that it's just got to stop. The Internet can... is the only hope we have for understanding climate change to the degree we can. It's a tough one. But we also must find a way to have meaningful dialogue that doesn't put us into these separate bubbles, as has happened in the United States. There's currently no ability for somebody who's in the right-wing blogosphere to even have the slightest bit of potential respect for somebody in the left-wing part of the blogosphere, or vice versa. I mean, and we can't survive that. And I think the reason it happened is we stopped letting people be people, and instead we turned them into mobs for commercial purposes. And that has got to count as one of the worst mistakes ever, that almost all really, really bad things in human history come from turning people into mobs. It's a sin. It's something we shouldn't do.
Jaron Lanier, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio for our next program. I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today in Media Matters.
I'm very pleased to be here, and I really appreciate what you said about the book.
And for people who want to follow up, in addition to seeing the book, going to your website, jaronlanier.com. Anything else they should do in your mind to stay on top of what you're doing?
I would just say think. If you find yourself agreeing with everything I said, you haven't really read the book. Think for yourself. Be a person. Don't be part of a mob.
Well, on that wonderful note, thank you so much, Jaron Lanier. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, Melissa Trentz, my producer. I'm Bob McChesney. One week from today, we're going to have Joseph Stiglitz on the air, a recorded interview. I'll be back in 2 weeks live. Thank you all very much. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll have occasional showers today with a high around 50 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers this evening, a low of 32. Monday brings sunny skies with a high of 53. Monday night, mostly clear with a low of 33. And Tuesday, sunny with a high of 62. This is Illinois Public Media, WI.